Howdy, guys. Welcome to Ignite, or welcome back after your lunch. Everybody having a good Ignite? All right. Excellent. I'm so glad to hear it. Hey, so I'm Jeffrey Snover. I'm a technical fellow, and I'm joined today by...
Andrew Mason. I'm Principal Program Manager in Windows Server.
And...
Patrick Lang, I'm a senior program manager working on Windows containers.
Yeah, great. So today we're going to talk about some of the great innovation that we did in Windows Server 2012. Really excited about 2016. We did it again. 2016.
It's been a long week for me.
Okay, so in particular, we want to talk about how, you know, we've already talked to you about a bunch of the great innovation. Here, we're going to talk about a number of things that we did to make Windows Server better for DevOps. Okay? So, Andrew, what the heck is this slide?
What?
What's this slide?
This is all Windows Server 2016. It's awesome.
Great.
Built-in layers of security, software-defined data center, cloud-ready app platform. DevOps makes that all possible.
It's a beautiful thing. Perfect. Okay, so first, what is DevOps? Hey, how many people are using DevOps or think you're doing DevOps? Oh, good. Okay, great. So, you know, I go to a lot of conferences that talk about this question, what is DevOps? You go to a DevOps conference, you're going to see a bunch of people spending time asking this question, what is DevOps? And I've rarely walked away from any of those conversations hearing people say, well, that settles that. Now I know what DevOps is. However, there's generally a consensus that DevOps is about culture and processes. And indeed, I believe that it is, right? So in my mind, DevOps is all about this idea of saying, we're going to put customer first, and then we're going to re-engineer everything according to that. Right? And when you put the customer first, all of a sudden you need to start breaking down the walls between your developers and operators, and then there's a set of common practices that happen. But in general, you know, the one thing that everyone's very clear about is it's about tools, or sorry, it's about culture and processes, and it is not, DevOps is not about tools and technology, okay? But, you know, I think this is wrong, okay? This is wrong. And the reality is that tools and technology play a critical role in DevOps. It is true, people and processes are the higher to bid, but tools and technology play a critical role, right? Because tools and technologies can make it easy or can make it hard. And what we've done here is in Windows Server 2016, we've architected it to make DevOps easy. All right. So, in Windows Server 2016, what we have finally done is to resolve and architect the interface between the developers and the operators, right? And the reality is, before this, right, we're kind of this hippie culture, right? We were silent on the interface between developers and operators, right? There really was no architecture here. And we let a thousand blossoms bloom. Oh, do it any way you want, right? Anyway, that was great, except, you know, a thousand conflicts also bloomed, okay, as people wanted to do it one way and other parts of the organization wanted to do it another, and there was no coherent way to do a number of things that were really quite critical to a DevOps workflow. Windows Server 2016, we fixed that. We resolved the interface between them, and we do this for a traditional DevOps model, the one most people are doing today, and the new emerging DevOps model that containers enable. We believe that both containers and people not using containers should follow a DevOps process to drive their business value. But we believe that when you do DevOps with containers, the flow is a little bit different. We'll talk a little bit about that. The heart of it, right, I'll get to the punchline. The heart of it is that with containers, a bunch of the things that the operators used to do on instances are now done by the developer as part of their build lab. We'll talk more about that later. But Windows Server 2016 resolves the interface for both models. So why did we do this, right? And the answer is very simple, right? Let's talk about the evolution of Windows Server, right? It started off in Windows NT, right? Windows NT, we took a great kernel, Dave Cutler's kernel, we put a desktop experience on that, and we put it on PC class hardware. Transformed the world, just transformed the world. Because prior to Windows NT, servers were really the domain of the princes and high priests of technology. And when we put those combination of things together, the kernel, the experience, and the PC economics, now for the first time ever, anyone could buy, deploy, and operate their own server. And there were a ton of them, just transformed the world. So that was the era of server for the masses. There were so many of them, and there were so many PC clients, that we brought about the next era of Windows Server, and that's the enterprise era. In the enterprise era, we had Windows 2000, where we introduced Active Directory and group policy. And in 2003, we introduced .NET. And in .NET, guess what? We did it again, right? Now, with .NET, everybody could write their mission-critical line-of-business applications. We democratized that. Before that, you know, mission-critical line-of-business applications were, you know, the high priests and princes of technology. So, great. Now, it's important to note, server for the masses, how did you manage it? You walked up to your server, you gave it a little kiss, used the mouse and the keyboard, you managed it. Enterprise servers, hard to do, walk into each one of the servers. So we had RDP, remote desktop. You virtually walked over to it, but still you did local GUI management. You just remoted the local GUI. That changes with data centers. When we had this LOB application explosion, now all of a sudden we had line of business applications running on lots of servers. So we had to scale those servers up, we had to scale out those servers, we introduced virtualization technology to do server consolidation, and we started the rewrite of our server storage stack. A critical distinction here in this data center era is you don't manage data center servers with local GUIs. It's not how you do it. You do it through automation, and that's where PowerShell was introduced. Now, that was the technology that Windows Azure went and built upon. Okay, so Windows Azure was built upon these data center technologies, and now what we're doing is we're taking the great lessons of Windows of Azure, and we're bringing it back into Windows Server. Okay, so this brings about the cloud era for Windows Server. Now, it's important to note that each one of these eras is additive, not replacive, not replacement, okay? So Windows Server 2016, we focused heavily on being a great cloud server, but guess what? We're also a great data center server, we're also a great enterprise server, and if you want to buy an individual server, put it on a mantelpiece, have a desktop, have a keyboard and a mouse and a touchscreen monitor and say, hey Cortana, restart IIS, you can do that too. It's great for all these things. It's additive, not replacement. And of course, with cloud servers, you don't use GUIs to manage cloud servers, local GUIs to manage cloud servers. You do that through automation. So again, why did we do this? And the answer is to be cloud competitive, right? To be competitive in the cloud, you have to be small, you have to be fast, you have to minimize the attack surface, and you have to have minimal reboots, okay? Minimize the patches and reboots. And you have to be optimized for DevOps. If you have all these things, but you don't fit well into a DevOps workflow, you're not being a good operating system for the cloud. So, the cloud plus DevOps, what's this all about, right? I think of this as really this transformation between, you know, in the past, IT was all about saving money. Hey, I can save more. We used to say that, do more with less. Do more with less. Oh, I can save money. Oh yes, you can be efficient. DevOps in the cloud are not necessarily about being efficient. It's about being effective. There's a big difference between those two. It's not about saving money, it's about making money. We believe that the folks that can harness these technologies properly and get a great cycle going between listening to your customers, responding to their changes in code, and then deploying that code, and then doing it again, and your ability to listen well, and respond quickly will yield just incredible business advantage. So that's why this is so critical, okay? So the DevOpsification of Windows. Basically, there falls into the following categories of architecture that we've introduced in Windows Server 2016. It's important to note that Windows Server 2016 is the largest architectural change we have made to Windows Server really since the beginning. So this is a fundamentally different operating system. Now that said, it's still the operating system you're familiar with. If you want to do remote desktop, if you want to have it on a single machine, if you want to treat it as a data center, you can still do that. Don't freak out. But it is fundamentally different, and it's fundamentally different because it's awesome for the cloud. So what we did work in componentization of the operating system. It really got our development story upped, improved. We now resolve the issue of how to deal with packaging, repositories, and deployment, configuration and configuration management, containers, operational validation testing, and operating securely. So first, let's drill into componentization. So Windows Server 2016 has three deployment options. First deployment option is server in a desktop, SAD, because it makes me sad. Every time I see somebody with a local GUI in a desktop, it makes me sad. No, but this is a great deployment option for small businesses and for remote desktop. It is needed for remote desktop. Here what we've done is we have optimized for consistency with the client, okay? Next is Server Core. Server Core is for running your heritage data center applications in a very efficient way. And now we introduce NanoServer, our just enough operating system. This is perfect for containers, next generation applications, and frankly, to run the fabric of the cloud. Have I been talking through your slides?
Yes. Oh. You were on a roll, though. I didn't want to interrupt.
Oops.
So talk a little bit about NanoServer and how we optimize that for the cloud era. So with NanoServer, we're following a zero footprint or just enough OS model. So unlike Server Core and Server with a desktop, Jeffrey's sad environment, where you have a side-by-side folder, all the roles and features you could possibly install in Server Core or Server with a desktop are in that side-by-side folder. So they're consuming resources on your physical machines and in your virtual machines. With NanoServer, we separated that. So the side-by-side folder has a little bit of metadata that's there for patching purposes, but all the roles and features are separate CAB files. They're like applications that you install. So you can either include them in your image when you're building a NanoServer image, or you can add them at runtime, either by copying the CAB files in and using DISM to apply them, or with package management, as we'll see in one of the demos, you can actually pull them down from a cloud repository and install them. So that provides a much smaller initial install area and allows you to build an image for the role that server is going to perform. You don't have a lot of extra components or functionality installed on that server that aren't being used for what that server is doing on your network. And so that, in addition to that smaller footprint, it reduces the attack surface. There are fewer services running by default, fewer ports open. There's less to manage. There's less to configure. There's less that somebody could potentially misconfigure and expose that server to a security issue or attack. And so with NanoServer and Server 2016, we have Hyper-V, scale-out file server, clustering, DNS, and IIS all supported. So the key workloads you need for running it as a physical host or for running it as your app platform, either in a guest or even in a container. So we have full physical driver support. So if you have a driver for Server 2016 server that works in Server Core or Server with a desktop, you can install that same driver in a NanoServer image and use that. So same driver stack, same underlying networking stack and everything. Following that just enough OS model, Defender's available as well, but it's an optional package. Unlike Server Core and Server with a desktop where it's installed by default, it's an optional package. So if you're going to decide you don't want to use anti-malware or you're going to use a third party, you never have to have Defender bits in your image. So again, just enough OS. And then both the System Center Virtual Machine Manager and Operations Manager agents are available for installation on NanoServer. So you can use either of those to remotely manage and manage at scale your NanoServer deployments. Now with NanoServer, we've refactored PowerShell and created a PowerShell core. So it is a trimmed down version of PowerShell that runs on the .NET Core version of the CLR. So that's a subset of .NET that's available. But that gives us ability to use DSC. You get all the security capabilities, PowerShell, all the classes, access to the PowerShell gallery, all available through NanoServer. I mentioned that. And it provides full PowerShell language compatibility. So all the commandlets and types of commandlets are available in PowerShell Core. The one difference is they have to be factored to make sure they run inside of .NET Core. And we've added a lot of commandlets into NanoServer. So we do have a subset of the commandlets available, but those are the commandlets required to manage that subset that's available in NanoServer. And we've also gotten some new commandlets added to Windows Server 2016 just to make managing NanoServer even easier. So I know lots of people have wanted user and group commandlets for quite some time. Well, they're now available in 2016 because we wanted them for NanoServer. So it's helping us improve all the different types of server installation options you could use. And then we also have OpenSSH support. So the PowerShell team has created a version of OpenSSH. You can download this from GitHub, and it runs on NanoServer, Server Core, and Server with a desktop. So you can now use OpenSSH to remotely connect in and manage your servers.
Yeah, and on that, there are three elements to the OpenSSH support. So there is OpenSSH client and server, which will be available on Windows sort of as is. And then we've extended the PowerShell remoting protocol, or we are in the process of extending the PowerShell remoting protocol to support OpenSSH as an optional transport. That will first come in the Linux version and then be available on Windows in the subsequent version.
Right. And our PowerShell core, Open PowerShell, is open sourced and available cross-platform now.
Pretty rocking.
Yep. So I'm going to do a brief demo of
how to log into a computer.
Yes. Sorry. Of PowerShell Core on NanoServer. So I have a NanoServer virtual machine running here on my laptop that I will connect into using PowerShell remoting. So I'm now connected over the network to my virtual machine running NanoServer. And so press the right key.
Yeah, you did. It was just it had selected the T.
I'll stop touching the mouse. So if you do a directory listing of the registry under this particular key, HKEY local machine, software, Microsoft, Windows NT, current version, server, there's a server levels value. And what you can query that for is whether you're running on NanoServer, Server Core, or Server with a desktop. So if you need your scripts, your tools, your other things to behave differently, you can use that registry key. And that's actually existed since Server 2012. So 2012 and 2012 R2 had this for determining whether you're on Server Core or Server with a desktop. We've added a NanoServer level available now as well. And then the PowerShell team has added this great new commandlet called get computer info. This is kind of like system info on steroids. And so you can see here it shows you a bunch of your device guard configuration, your Hyper-V configuration, and a lot of the other data you might get on from system info, and then some. Well, that's a nice long list, but you can filter it down just like you can with anything else in PowerShell. And one of the things hiding in there is server levels. So you can also use this commandlet to find out what installation option you're running on.
Yeah, because honestly, how many of you were writing down that registry key, right?
Yeah,
yeah, right. What the heck?
It's documented on MSDN.
Yeah.
Okay, get computer info, remember that one. It's a very handy commandlet. So in addition to having PowerShell remoting and be able to running PowerShell commandlets, you can also run a lot of your standard command line tools that you know and love from the many years of Windows Server on your NanoServer box. Now, you can also access WMI, but you cannot use get WMI object on NanoServer. So that's one of the differences we have in core PowerShell. Instead, use git sim instance. And so here you can see git WMI object didn't work, but using the same set of parameters and everything, git sim instance showed me I'm running on NanoServer 1.
Yeah, just so you know there, we've been trying to signal that the git WMI stuff was going to be deprecated, and we wanted people to use the git sim instance because it uses the WSMAN protocol by default, which is firewall friendly, and has the option to use DCOM if and when you need it. So that's a better way of doing things.
Right, so in addition to PowerShell Core, NanoServer supports WMI, so we have WMI V1 and V2, so you can use that if there isn't an equivalent commandlet available. Now, we have a lot of, as I mentioned, we've been porting a lot of stuff over to run on top of NanoServer, so I just did a git module list available, and you can see there's a long list there. Bunch of networking
scroll.
Things, PKI.
You gotta scroll so you see, they see the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah, see, you were hiding some.
I was hiding some, yes, okay. If you do git command, again, a long list comes through. I'm not gonna scroll through it because I'll just measure. So, 865 commandlets compared to about 3,000 in full server, but there's a lot of things you don't need a commandlet for in nano server.
Well, in particular with full server, a bunch of things that are now components are already installed. So as you start adding additional components, you'll see that list go up and up and up.
And then let's take a look at the services running on the system. So that's a fair list scrolled by, but I also have a server with a desktop virtual machine that I've connected into. And if I run that same list, you'll see much longer list scroll by. So let's do a little comparison here. So I have 31 services running by default on my nano server machine. If I do the same thing on my server with a desktop, I have 72. Quite a difference. Makes Jeffrey very happy.
Very happy.
One of the other things we've done is we've also worked to port a lot of the command line sysinternal tools over. In addition to PowerShell and WMI, you have the sysinternal command line tools available. So if you go up to the sysinternal's website, there's a link there where you can download the nano server versions of these. The nano server versions run on any of your server installs. The big difference, in addition to being factored to run on nano server, is they're all native 64-bit.
The developer for that, you know, he's just sort of this lazy guy, sort of resting on his laurels. It's like, dude, have you heard of this thing called 64-bit? He says, what? Well, it's 64-bit. It's what comes after 32-bit. Had to explain that like four or five times. But now,
got it. And
then we added the contractors and did the work anyway.
So you can see there's a long list of the command line versions of sysinternal tools, and they all have 64 in their name, so you know they're the 64-bit versions. So I'm going to run pslist here on my nano server machine. See, that works. Gives me a list. If I switch back over to my full server here and run that, you'll see a much longer list. If I list DLLs, scrolls and scrolls and scrolls, I can probably get over here and even type it.
The race is on.
Oh, I couldn't type fast enough. You can see a much shorter list. So we can also run disk usage report. And so 573 megabytes on disk. If I run that on my full server, and I'm only going to do it in SQL and backslash Windows because I was using this for some other demos, so it's got some other stuff in other folders. See, that's going to take a long time. While it's thinking about that, the great thing we have with PowerShell Core, and in addition to running on NanoServer, we have all the new features and functionality of PowerShell that are available in Server 2016. So copy item, they added a from session and to session, there it goes, 8.5 gigabytes, just in the Windows folder. If I deleted some of the other stuff and included the program files and stuff, it would be nearly 10 gigabytes. So from session and to session are both available in NanoServer. So rather than having to create a network connection and to copy a file over,
yeah, so it's worth describing what's going on here. So when we did nano server, right, there's no local logon, no local logon. So everything has to be managed remotely. So in the past, when we were trying to do, you know, manage everything in server core, you know, there's always like, okay, but, you know, there's always this escape hatch. Well, you know, they could always do this or they could always do that. With nano server, there is no escape hatch, right? And so that forced us to go really re-up our Windows server game. A remoting game. Are you going to show PS Edit?
I'm going to show which?
PS Edit.
I was not going to show PS
Edit. I'll show that when you're done. But so one of the things was now you can do PowerShell remoting, file transfer over PowerShell remoting. Again, to make this, yeah, you like that one. Yeah, give it up. Okay, so you can do that, and to make it easier, you can transfer things from and to.
So it's not happy with my command line here for some reason.
Current demo notwithstanding.
I know.
From session, Yeah? Oh, you're in the session. That's why you're supposed to get out of the session.
I forgot my to exit. Sorry. Yes, bonehead move.
McFly.
Yes, yes, I know. All right, there we go. It's still doing like that.
From session to okay. Yeah. Step aside, my friend. Right. Step aside.
We'll let the PowerShell expert do this.
Oh, where are we? Oh, what happened?
I don't know what I messed up.
What did I do? What? Oh, did you put Zoom It on this?
Yeah, Zoom It's on it.
Oh, good Lord.
Control Z.
Why would you do such a thing?
That was for a different demo.
Well, now how do I undo?
I'll fix this while you're doing your next demo.
What? Okay, well, anyway, let me show. What? This is insane. Okay, well, listen, let me show you this. Enter PS session. Oh, gosh darn it. Dollar, what was it? Dollar NS2?
Yes, NS1.
NS1. Okay, so check this out. /temp.
Oh, that's what I did wrong. No, I know what I did wrong.
Okay. Okay, well, hold on a second. Let me finish. I'm doing a demo. Okay. So here I've got remote. I'm connected to that remote machine. So I'm on a client, and I'm connected to a remote nano server. Oh, there's this file, foo.txt. I'd love to take a look at that thing. I'd love to edit it. PS edit. Ba-doom. Brings it up locally. And you see up here it says remote file. How's that? Control Z? There. Remote file.
Came in handy.
Wow. Now what do I do? Okay. Anyway, so there you go. Is you got remote file editing. If I wanted to. You can save that. We'll save that. And then just to see. Get out of here. Go away. Anyway, so then say cat foo.txt. Voila, there it is. There you go. Okay, so now you were going to say?
Yes, I created the temporary folder when I was in my remote session instead of when I was. So I think.
Oh, and now you're in that session.
So yes, I know. I will exit. But what did you do to me?
I changed something. That's why you need Control Z. This mapping it to Zoom, now you can't undo. So I'd close that file and.
You closed that file on me. There we go. Aha.
I have no idea why that was a good idea.
Why what? Zoom it?
Yeah.
All right, that's empty. Now this is going to work. There we go. I was still in my remote session when I created the folder I was copying into.
Oh.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Okay.
So, is there anything else you wanted to show?
No, it's awesome. It's all good stuff. Thanks.
You don't want to break my network?
What? Oh, yeah. Okay, so now check this out. This is crazy fun. Crazy fun. Hey, so enter. Where are you?
If you scroll down it.
Enter PS session. NS1. Get net adapter. Okay, look. See that net adapter? Check this out. What do you think?
It's going to make PowerShell remoting hard for me.
Are you sure you want to do this? Yeah, let's have some fun. Notice everything freezes. I wonder why.
Thank you,
Screw
Jeffrey.
With my demo, my friend.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
See if sysinternals can help you with that.
I'm not going to count on sysinternals for that one. So what I am going to do, though, is open up PowerShell ISE again and open my demo file. So there's actually two ways I could fix this. Since this is Nano Server, I have an emergency management console, and because I'm admin on both, I could use VM Connect and go open the emergency management console. But what I'm going to do instead is use enter PS session over PowerShell Direct. And so because I'm admin, I can connect without using the network.
So here you say enter PS session, but notice it's saying VM name. VM name. Remember I said that we support multiple protocols on PowerShell remoting? We support WinRM. We now support PowerShell Direct. It goes over the VM bus. So if you've disabled the NICs, you can still do PowerShell remoting. It's crazy.
And so you can see I have no network configuration because somebody disabled it on me. So if I go enable network adapter over that and then get my configuration again, I'm now back on the network and I can go back to regular network-based PowerShell remoting.
Pretty sweet.
If I wanted to, yes.
Pretty sweet. All right.
So development, the next phase after our componentization and minimizing the install option. You know, we learned a lot with Server Core and the developer experience we provided with that, which was pretty minimal, basically a web page on MSDN. So for all the developers out there that love that, we have the same thing for NanoServer. There is a MSDN page with all the APIs that work in NanoServer. But what we've also done is integrated with the Windows SDK and with Visual Studio. So there's a Visual Studio template you can download. And then you can, when you do a new project, select NanoServer as your target. And what that gives you is the full developer experience. So you get autocomplete when you're typing APIs, but it's only going to show you APIs available in NanoServer. If you load in some code that you already have and it's calling using any APIs that aren't available in NanoServer, you also get little red squiggles under it. So it tells you that you're using an API that's not going to work when you try and run that code on NanoServer. We have a full remote debugging experience. In addition to that, we also have a couple of tools available, NanoServer API Scan. So for any native code that you may have, you can run NanoServer API Scan against it, and it will show you what APIs you're calling that aren't available in NanoServer, as well as, in many cases, substitutions you can use. We actually use that internally on the NanoServer team and use that when we're porting the sysinternals tools. So it's not only a tool made available for you all, but we use it internally as we're porting things over to NanoServer and helping teams figure out how to move their code to NanoServer. And then the .NET Core team has a similar tool called API Portability Analyzer, and that allows you to scan your managed code and see what classes you're calling and what .NET profile those are applicable in, so you can see what adjustments you may need to make there. And as far as packaging and deployment goes, you know, first, a word about MSIs. They're not supported on NanoServer. MSIs have a lot of GUI dependencies, as well as allow you to run custom actions. And those are apparently the portal to hell.
Exactly.
So custom actions are a bad thing. They let you run any code. You know, whoever wrote that MSI can call anything on the system, especially if you're running it as an admin. Who knows what kind of changes they're making on your machine and what they're calling out to. So rather than trying to make MSI work and trying to figure out a way to make it possible for an administrator to determine what MSIs would run on NanoServer out of the hundreds of thousands that are out there, you know, we built a new installer for Windows Server. It's the Windows Server App Installer. So this is a new declarative installer, and it is based off of AppX. So it layers on top of AppX, uses the same schema, but adds a bunch of extension handlers specific to servers. So it lets you do things like install NT services, performance counter, ETW providers, COM objects. And now, it does not allow for custom actions, and these are all extensions that are available only on servers. So if you create a WSA package, you cannot install that on a client machine. But you can take, if you're familiar with a client Centennial installer, you can take Centennial packages, and those will install on server as well as NanoServer. So there's consistency between the underlying API schema. There are just some extensions that are specific to server if you need those for whatever you're installing.
Yeah, so when it comes to package management, here's the problem we wanted to solve. Package management is a mess. Right? It's a mess. So if you take a look on your right, you'll see there's a ton of package sources, right? We'll have a WSA package repository. There's the PowerShell gallery. There's the container gallery. There's Docker. There's NuGet. There's Chocolaty. Node.js has their own. Everybody's got their own repository. There's a whole bunch of them. But what we want to do is to give you an experience on your left, and that is a simple, coherent experience of packages, right? So we want to define the interfaces for discovery, the ability to install, uninstall them, inventory. And in between those two things, we solve this by having package providers. These package providers are a piece of code that knows about the repositories, how to use a protocol to enumerate what things are in those repositories, how to retrieve things from those repositories, how to install them, how to uninstall them, and how to do inventory. And they do it across the various different things. And for any package provider, it can talk to different sources. So just think NuGet, right? Well, there's the NuGet gallery, but then we often set up our own private NuGets. So that provider can talk to different sources to get their packages, right? So it kind of sounds complex, but the reality is you're left with an experience like this. Find package, searches for the package. Install package, installs the package. Any confusion? Okay, right? Pretty simple stuff. Save the package, that downloads it and saves it to disk, but doesn't install it, so you can inspect it. Get the package, gets the inventory of packages on the current machine, and uninstall the package, right? And so here is a find package provider, right? And you see lots of package providers. So let's just go to a demo. Let's show you this, because it's pretty rockin' stuff. All right. So first, I'll get command from the module package management. And I'm gonna sort that by noun and name. And you'll see here, let's do it this way, I guess. Yeah, okay, great. So you see we have packages. We have packages. You find them, get them, install them, save them. We have package providers. Find them, install them. And package sources. And the key things there are you register them and unregister them. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to get the current set of packages on my current machine. And then I'm going to say OV. PKG. OV stands for output variable. It captures the thing, captures the output of the pipeline. So you see all these things. Boy, well, you know what? I got quite a lot of packages on this system. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to package them. Sorry, I'm going to group them by provider. Okay, so on my computer, I've got 183 MSIs, 140 things, 44 things from PowerShell Get, 29 things from packet programs. I'm not really sure what that one is. So let's drill into that one. So what I do is I say, get package, provider name, programs, and format table. Oh, I see Visual Studio, C++. Okay, those are programs. Now, I'll take a look and see all the things that I got from PowerShell Get. And here are my DSC resources. Oh, I've got some modules. I might even have some scripts from that. Okay? So now let's take a look at the package providers that I have. Okay? So I've currently got programs, PowerShell Get, NuGet, MSI, and MSU. But take a look at the package sources. I'm just getting it from two. Some of these providers have hardwired sources. Some of them have configurable sources. Here I've got two sources for PowerShell Get. The same provider, PowerShell Get, has two sources. The public PowerShell gallery and then the internal PowerShell team gallery. But I want to do some more. So let's pull down, find out what some other package providers are. And I see, oh, there's Chocolaty. So if you're not familiar with Chocolaty, it's pretty familiar. So let's install that. Let's finish.
There's also NanoServer.
Say again? Oh, and yes, NanoServer. Thank you. That's where you're going to get your NanoServer packages. Remember, we start off small, and then you grow. How do you grow? You download packages. Okay? So now I've installed Chocolaty. And let's see how this is going to go. Sometimes this takes a really long time, because there are so many things in Chocolaty. So it's out there, it's enumerating all the things in the Chocolaty provider. Oh, it came back quickly, good. So take a look, count, that's not too many. What happened there? That's suspiciously small. Typically that's like a couple thousand. So let's take a look here. ST, no, it didn't quite work right. Let's try that again. Well, let's try this. There was a package that should have been there called ASTLY, something to do with ASTs. You know, PowerShell now supports a public AST. AST is an abstract syntax tree, so I wanted to download the package associated with that. It says, hey, are you sure you want to install this software from Chocolaty? It's like, well, it's got an AST package, why not? Sure. That's disturbing. We were supposed to have audio, guys. There you go. Thank you. Now, I'm making a point here. I just love that stuff. By the way, this is the fabulous Lee Holmes famous Rickroll, ASCII text Rickroll, okay? He's just a brilliant guy. Now, how did I get that, right? How did I get Rickrolled? And the answer was, I just installed the package. So what's up with that? And the answer is, the chocolatey model is one where it will download a package, deploy that package, and look for a file called install chocolatey.ps1. And then it runs it. Well, guess what? That thing can do anything. So, you know, I'm pointing out here that you're not, you know, maybe trusting everything from these package providers isn't such a good idea. And so instead, what you might want to do is you might want to say, hey, let's save that package to the temp directory and then open it up looking at that file and then examining it. Okay? So again, I want to highlight the fact that, you know, be careful with these package repositories. In general, big enterprise is going to want to set up their own repository and pull things from the public repository that they know and they trust and have everybody do that. So now I'll register a new package source for the NuGet. And when I find source NuGet, this is where we have a bunch of developer-oriented packages. And just take a look at this thing. This thing's just going to go on and on and on. So again, we've made it pretty easy to go find, make it easy for you to find all the stuff in your environment and manage it, right? So gone will be the days of the scavenger hunt to try and configure your operating system. Again, this thing's going to go on, so let's just go back to the slides.
Do you want to show the NanoServer package provider?
Oh, let's, or we could show the NanoServer package provider. Good heavens.
Yes.
Remember, NanoServer is small. You get the packages from where? You get them from the net.
Well, they are available in the media as well, so you can put them in the image when you initially create your image if you want to.
Yep, that's one of the choices.
That's one of the choices.
This is cooler.
This is cooler. Not as cool as your Rick Astley demo, though.
No, that is awesome.
So just to prove I've connected up to another NanoServer VM here, I'm going to do server level, and it's showing me NanoServer. And then I will start installing the package provider, because it's going to take a moment, and it's going to come up and ask me to install NuGet.
And so this is sort of a page faulting mechanism. The thing, the provider, to pull down the providers is, guess what? It's in a repository. So what we're doing is we're going to a repository to pull down the provider and register it. And then having registered it, then we can pull down other packages.
Right, so I just imported the package provider, and now if I do a find package, it's going to show me all the packages available. And so, talked some about that just enough OS model earlier. Well, in technical preview 4, we put NanoServer up in the Azure gallery as one of the choices that you could deploy. The problem with that was we figured out that it was going to be kind of painful for people to then, that was the base image, to then copy cab files into it and use DISM to apply the cabs they wanted to use. So what we did was we broke our just enough OS model and we created a packages folder in the root of that VHD. So it made the VHD bigger, you know, we just put the side-by-side folder back but named it packages. So as part of technical preview 5, we wanted to eliminate that. So we created this new package provider and posted all the roles and features that you can install in NanoServer, as you can see from the list here, up in a repository. And so that TP5 version of NanoServer in the Azure gallery is just the base NanoServer. Then you can use the NanoServer provider to install the package that you may want on the system. And so this is the same thing with the general availability bits. I'm actually using the eval here. So if I don't remember the name of the package I want to install, rather than having to go out and find TechNet or whatever, if I know I want a VMM agent or DSC, it supports wildcards, so I can search for that and filter it down. And then if I run git package on my machine, you'll see it's going to parse through the system for me. And I have the NanoServer guest package because I'm running in a virtual machine. I have data center because that's the edition I installed, and sort of the foundation, the base of Windows. And then just to prove that I haven't cheated and created a packages folder again or anything, you know, you can see the root of my system is pretty basic. If I search for DSC binaries, because that's what I'm going to install, all I have is WDS core, which is part of the servicing engine, and the KDS client. So pretty No DSC hiding in the system. I'll even scroll up to system 32. You can see PowerShell folder doesn't show up. But then I can go off and just tell it, I want DSC, install DSC for me. And so you can use this as part of your workflows. If you want to create a base nanoserver image and then customize it based on what it needs to run, you can inject the packages and roles and features you need at runtime. So now it just installed DSC for me. If I do my git package again, I'll have the DSC package in my list. So I've gone from 3 to 4 packages. And you'll see it's installed a bunch more files on the system for me, as quick as that was pulling it down from the internet. There's a bunch more there, including some binaries in system 32. And if I scroll up enough here, I'll finally get to the PowerShell folder as well, now has some contents.
Awesome. Okay, so now let's talk about configuration. We introduced desired state configuration in Windows Server 2012 R2. It is a declarative way to express how you want your system to be. Okay, so it's declarative versus imperative. You say, I want these components to be in this state, and then you run a script and make it so. And then we have something called the local configuration management agent, which will make it so, and it can monitor to detect any drift. If there is any drift, it can warn you about that drift, or it can auto-correct that drift after having warned you. This is very much a platform technology. Yes, you can script it yourself and do that. We find that as people do that, they often say, hey, what about a solution? Something that ties it all together. And that's exactly what we meant it to be. It meant it to be a platform technology. So we work with our great partners like Chef and Puppet and Azure Automation. So we have a solution in this space as well. In fact, we're showing that at the booth. That's the basis for some of our, if you saw in the keynote, the update management stuff, patch management, that's using this technology. This is available on, we make it available down level all the way to 2008 R2 and on Linux via our OMI providers. And we got a ton of resources. These just continue to generate lots and lots of resources. Patrick.
All right, thank you. All right, so now it's time to talk a little bit about containers. So traditional virtual machines were something that we initially designed and implemented in Hyper-V to provide hardware virtualization. You can run any OS you want, any application you want on top of it. But what you're doing is you're taking all that state and putting it into one big place. And then when you try to move it, that can be difficult. Containers took a different approach that had already been well established in the community, and that is virtualize the operating system and provide just what you need to actually run your application. So you take your application, any changes in configuration that are needed around it, let's say you want to add some Windows roles and bring in your application files and all of that, you wrap it all together, and now you've got a container. A container itself is something that you can go ahead and share and run on multiple machines. They're really easy to create, and they're even faster to deploy. So the first flavor we offer is Windows Server containers. These give you excellent speed and density because you're using the same Windows OS kernel, but you're just sharing it and redeploying what needs to be different between each container. So great consolidation, really easy to deploy. You can go ahead and run these in your data center or any public cloud today, as long as you're running Windows Server 2016. And then we also offer what are known as Hyper-V containers, where we've used the hypervisor that was originally intended for VMs to provide a much lighter weight VM to wrap up just enough kernel and the container that you're going to run. So if you're restricted by compliance and you need to do things like ensure that one customer's data is separate from another one, maybe you've got multiple tenants because you're a hoster, or you simply just different levels of security classification, you can run each container in its own hypervisor boundary for additional security. But the other thing it does is it actually lets us cross multiple OS versions. So in the demo, I'm actually going to be running a Windows 10 Anniversary Edition laptop, but I'm running my favorite new server OS in the container. So first off, what I have here is a simple web application that I started. I did this using some of the great new DevOps tools that work alongside .NET Core, and I just was able to create a basic project using, simply by saying, yo ASP.NET, created a project with all the scaffolding, and then I was able to go ahead and build it. So first I'll go ahead and publish what I have here. I can actually get this built. I'm very tired, so I need to copy this. Okay, so what I'm doing right now is this is actually going to build any files that need to be built, and then it's actually taking all of the application binaries plus the other static content, and it's putting it all in one location. That's very convenient for me because then I can go ahead and use that as a staging location for what needs to go into the container. So if I look at the Docker file here, I'll skip that update for later. Within the Docker file, I'm saying what the base container I want is. In this case, I'm saying, go get me a pre-made Microsoft .NET image. So this is based on NanoServer Core, and it's got .NET Core already installed on it. So this is coming from a public repository known as Docker Hub. Go ahead and add the folder containing my app, and then run it, and then also dump the network address so I can easily see it. So now the next step that I need to do here is to actually build the container. So this Docker build command is just packaging up all those files that are already there and following the instructions within the Docker file. So behind the scenes, this is actually creating a scratch base for this container. And then when it needs to actually run something, it spins up an instance of NanoServer in a container, runs it, and then at the end, it's going to store that result, and now I've got a container image that I can deploy. So I'll give this just a few more seconds here to keep running. But in the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and get my next window open here. So that first one was running the master branch of that project. So I'm going to go ahead and deploy that. Well, hold on, it's being a little slow right now. So this laptop has been through a whole lot today. Okay, now we're cooking. Okay, so now it's successfully built the container, and now, so the next step is to go ahead and run it. So I'm running the container that I just built, and right now it's quickly spinning up the NanoServer in the background. By the time I finish that sentence, it's already launched, and now the web server is there waiting for requests. So I'm gonna copy that IP address, go over to my favorite browser, and pull it up. So now we see that the request hit the container, I'm getting my logs there, now I've got the site up and running. But this is DevOps. I need to move faster than this. So we're going to try to talk a little bit faster. But next thing I'm going to do here is go ahead and do a git branch dash -l and say, OK, well, let's go ahead and let's check out this first branding branch. So git check out. OK, so I just switched over to another branch. And if I want to redeploy this, all I got to do is quickly rebuild the code. And then using exactly the same steps that I did before, I'll be able to go ahead and build a new container. So I'll call this one revision 2. So now this is picking up the new version of the files, and it's actually going to store it in a separate container that's going to be revision number 2. And I can deploy it side by side with the first one. So while that's going, so this is just a simple MVC net or ASP.NET MVC application. And it's got a lot of pre-configured stuff on there, but I can, you know, responds quickly and all of that. Okay, so now this one is building. So on this one, I can go ahead and say build version 2. Okay, so now I've run my second version here. So now I have two NanoServer containers running side by side on the same machine. And apparently I managed to break my network. That's what I get for going too fast. But anyway, so using Windows 10 Anniversary Edition, I can go ahead and easily develop applications using .NET Core or whatever platform I want, package them up in containers, and deploy them in just a few simple commands. And when I'm ready to go deploy this on Azure or within my own data center, I can use the same exact tooling to actually deploy it in that location. But apparently I broke my network stack, so I don't get, oh no, actually, I'm so tired I forgot the port number. Yep, there we go. Okay, so now I've got the next branch deployed on there. And so it makes it really, really easy for me to go ahead and deploy multiple things side by side. So using this, my devs could deploy as much stuff as they want, as quickly as they want, and get work done. So anyway, that's what I've got for now.
Great, right, thanks Patrick.
Thank you.
Patrick. So next I want to talk about operational validation testing, right? And this is a concept that's new to many people, and this video helps illustrate the basic problem that we have, right? So sometimes you can have a perfectly configured system that just does not operate, okay? Another computing example with this would be a server which is perfectly configured, except that somebody forgot to plug in the Ethernet. If you're looking at it, you could see, oh, all the settings look right, et cetera. But in operation, it doesn't work. Okay, so we want to address that problem. We are extending adding just a very thin layer on top of a unit test framework called Pester and calling it operational validation testing. Pester is a unit test framework, very similar to lots of different language frameworks, unit test frameworks. You describe a scenario. You then describe a test. The SQL service should be running. You give it some code. That code will invoke something, get service, and grab the status. And then you assert some condition. The status should be running. And you have a series of these things, okay? And then when you're done, you clean up. So you author these things, and then the idea is this. Here's a kind of a gut check. When do you get to go home after Patch Tuesday? Yeah? When do you get to go home? And in general, there's not a good answer. In general, there's the, I don't know, I go home and I just watch the phone and hope it doesn't ring. Okay, well, that's kind of a messy world. Imagine instead you went and ran a bunch of tests like this, right? Before you did the test, before you did the update, before you did the patch. So you invoke this test. It says describing simple validation of a SQL server. By the way, we have this idea of simple, quick and dirty validation, and then detailed validation. The quick and dirty are the, hey, make sure the high-level things are working. If something goes wrong, then you might want to run the detailed one that drills into lots of the details so you find out more precisely where it is. Anyway, so you run this validation, and you say, oh, the SQL server should be running. It is. The SQL Server agent service should be running. It is. Should be listening on a particular port. Should be able to query information. So you see that SQL Server is in pretty good shape, and then you do the patch, and you run this again. And if you see that all green, happy days, go home. If you see that something broke, chances are that patch wasn't a good thing. That's the world we're trying to get to, a world where we can engineer confidence in our IT operations. We engineer confidence in our IT operations by being able to have tests to make sure everything runs and then run those tests on a pretty frequent basis. And again, something goes wrong. Hey, blah. What do? Step number one, run these tests. It's going to help auto-diagnose what's gone wrong so you can focus in on that. So let's talk about operating securely. Right? We got two players here. We got Michael Hayden. Michael Hayden was a four-star general, director of the NSA, director of the CIA, director of national intelligence. Anybody got stuff more important to secure than this guy? No. Anybody got a bigger budget to secure stuff than this guy? No. Okay. But then there was this other guy, Edward Snowden, right? 30-year-old college dropout. Now, Michael Hayden made a decision. Michael Hayden made a decision that he will regret the rest of his life. He told this guy he could be an admin. And that was a bad call. And the reason why is that, once you have the admin, you have the keys to the kingdom. So much so that, in fact, the NSA had one of the released documents that Snowden published was called I Hunt and Hack System Admins. That's right, the NSA is hacking you guys, like literally you, not like people like me. I mean literally you. And why you? And the answer is because you have the credentials that give them the keys to the kingdom, that give them the ability to do anything that they want. So we have a number of technologies that now helps address that problem. The first of this is JIA, Just Enough Administration. This is available down level in our WMF 5.0. And basically it has the idea of saying, hey, once you're on a server, an administration action can do anything. Here what we say is, you no longer have to be an admin to do admin tasks, okay? You're a user, you connect into a server, I give you elevated privileges for that session. In fact, it's better than that. I actually create a temporary high-privileged account with admin privileges with your name and run things in that context, so that means that all the audit logging gets traced back to you. And then configure an environment where you can only perform a certain set of actions. Okay? A lot of customers have very large number of admins on particular machines because contractors need to get in there and reboot machines or update software and reboot machines. But once they're on there, they can do anything. So instead with JIA, what you can do is you can say, hey, all you contractors, you're not admins. You're never an admin. You're a user. But when you connect in and get authenticated, you get a high-privileged account to perform software management and rebooting of the machine and nothing else. So that's the role of JIA. So a scenario goes like this. Got a Edward Snowden. He enters a PowerShell session to a particular machine. He enters into the maintenance endpoint. At this point, he can restart a service. That's an authorized thing. Happy days. But then when he tries to steal secrets, I just love that. You know, error, you are not authorized to steal secrets, right? He can perform only the actions he's been authorized to perform and nothing else. Right, so now let me recap. We've done a number of things to make Windows Server 2016 better for DevOps. We did componentization, we went over that. We went over development, we went over packaging, repositories, and deployment, configuration and configuration management, containers, operational validation testing, and operating securely. Indeed, Windows Server 2016 resolves this interface between the developers and the operators. And of those things that we went through, the ones in orange or gold are available down level. Some of these are only available in Windows Server 2016, but wherever possible, we made them available down level as well. Again, why did we do this? We wanted to be small and fast. Nano Server, pretty darn small. We didn't go over the numbers, did we?
Coming up.
Oh, why don't you talk about those? Do the honor, my friend.
All right. So to Jeffrey's point about cloud competitive and being small, fast, minimizing your attack surface, deploy, start up, reboot quickly, that's what you need to be for be optimized for DevOps. So let's look a little bit about where NanoServer has landed in 2016. So these are all comparisons between NanoServer and Server Core. You know, Server with a desktop makes Jeffrey sad, so I left it off the bar graphs. 73 drivers loaded compared to 98. Services running, 28 compared to 47. Significant reduction in ports as well, 12 compared to 30. So again, that's minimizing that attack surface you might have, giving you the smallest base to start with, and then you can build what you need on top of that, layering in the pieces, only the pieces you require. As far as resource utilization goes, fewer processes, 21 compared to 26, but really the big benefit here is the boot I/O and the kernel memory used. So 108 megabytes compared to 306, and kernel memory in use, 61 megabytes compared to 139. So that gives you much faster boot time, reboot time, you're up and in production much more rapidly. So we have a demo of a virtual machine running in the NanoServer booth, and from running to fully rebooted and running again is in 8 seconds. Virtual machine on a little Intel NUC. So no fancy server class hardware, anything behind that. So you can really get up and running very quickly, and container startup times are super fast with NanoServer.
Yeah, and that's particularly important when you have like a virtualization host with lots of VMs. If those VMs are NanoServer VMs, when they all reboot at the same time, the fact that we have so fewer boot IOs means everybody is up and faster running. And the fact that we consume so much less kernel memory means you can have greater more memory available to the application and or have greater VM density.
Right, one of our TAP customers that has technical preview 5 in production has actually increased their VM density from about 8 VMs per server to 12 to 14 VMs per server and reduced their operational cost. So as far as deployment improvements go, NanoServer takes about 35 seconds to deploy a new one. Server Core is about 5 minutes. So we've moved some of the configuration settings that you would set in an unattend file into the offline section of an unattend, so they get applied on first boot. You don't even get that second reboot that you normally get. So you can get a new NanoServer machine up very quickly. And then as far as footprint goes, 460 megabytes for the base, compared to 5.5 gigabytes. Now, running in a virtual machine, there's a little bit of overhead, adds a whole 20 megabytes to a NanoServer image compared to nearly a gigabyte for a Server Core image. So you can see how much smaller, lighter weight, faster, and reduced attack surface is really focused on those cloud native apps and the DevOps type scenarios.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, the NanoServer team just hit a home run here. All right, so remember, DevOps is indeed about culture, and it's about processes, right? Those are the higher order bits. Those are the things that drive your customers, you know, drive your business forward to help better serve customers. But the reality is that tools and technology can make DevOps easy or can make it hard. And Windows Server 2016 is optimized and architected to make DevOps easy. I talked about these four eras. These four eras are interesting to think through the various challenges you have throughout your career and throughout you know, what it is you're trying to do with your IT. Windows Server 2016 remains a great server for each one of these eras, but each one of these eras did things differently. Remember, you did things with a local GUI for server for the masses, remote GUI for enterprise servers, for data center servers, you did automated. The cloud, you gotta do things differently. You have to do things differently for the cloud. It's a new game. So the most important thing you can do is to decide where you want your IT to be and then embrace it. If you wanna stay server for the masses, that's fine, that's great. If you wanna be in that data center era, that's fine, that's great. But if you wanna be in the cloud, you got to recognize that your tools probably have to change, your processes have to change, and maybe even some of your people need to change. Because the one sure way to fail is to want to go somewhere and then have partners, tools, techniques, or employees that don't want to go there. Okay? So in these times of great change, sometimes the job outgrows good people. So you got to decide, hey, do your people want to go there? And if so, everything's great. And if not, make sure you get the right people to help lead you to the change to the cloud. So there's a bunch of other related sessions. I think some of them are still ahead of us. If not, these will be available at msignite.com. And thank you. I don't think we have time for Q&A. But thank you for your time and attention. Hope you have a great Ignite.